In association with Newsarama.com, welcome back to Word Balloon, the comic book conversation show. This is John Suntress. Today, artist Tim Bradstreet covers it all. In this interview, we discuss Tim's early years, the development of his style of art, and explore his work on books like Vertigo's Hellblazer, his current collaborations with his Roar Entertainment partners Steve Niles and Tom Jane on books like Bad Planet and Alien Pig Farm 3000. We'll also take a glimpse at a very personal project of Tim's in the works for over two decades, Red Sky Diary. This episode of Word Balloon is sponsored by InStock Trades at InStockTrades.com. InStock Trades offers a huge selection of trade paperbacks, hardcovers, essentials, showcases, archives, absolute editions, omnibus editions, and more. All at up to 35% off, with orders over $50 receiving free shipping. And don't forget to visit InStock Trades' sister site, Discount Comic Book Service, at dcbservice.com for all your pre-order needs. Major publishers are 40% off, and monthly specials are 45 to 75% off every month. Visit InStock Trades at InStockTrades.com and Discount Comic Book Service at dcbservice.com. To illustrate some of the examples of Tim's work that we discuss in this interview, we recommend that you go to a couple places on the web, like Tim's TypePad space, which is timbradstreet.typepad.com. Tim's MySpace page at myspace.com/tbradstreet, and Tim's personal project, Red Sky Diary, at myspace.com/redskydiary. But before we get into all that, our conversation begins with an explanation of how Tim and I go back into the 80s, really, when it comes to knowing each other. Whenever I've had guests on in the past and your name comes up, I always bring up the fact that you and I were in school together.
Yeah.
I wouldn't say we were friends, but we were acquaintances because I would go into the comic book store they used to work in, and I'd see you, you know, once a week.
Yeah, and Jesus, man, you are going way back. That's like one of those things that I mention a lot, especially like I used to be a frequent visitor on the Straight to Hell Hellblazer forums.
Okay.
And, you know, all those guys are UK. There, at the beginning, there was all this pressure of what do the UK guys think of this American doing this, their icon, you know. But that was all cool. But the story about how I got to Hellblazer was really interesting because, you know, I could harken back to that, working at that comic shop there on Main Street in Bloomington, remembering when that first issue came out and those Dave McKean covers and how, you know, here's this guy working in a comic shop wanting to get into comics, you know, loving this Hellblazer book, and then coming, you know, that full circle journey to being offered the job of doing it is just, God, I've just had so many lucky, but chances to kind of, like, have dreams come true, you know what I mean?
Yeah, and get your fingerprints on work that you had already admired as a fan.
Totally. I mean, and from Hellblazer to, you know, working on a Punisher movie, doing movie posters, I mean, if you had told me that when I was 19 years old, I would have lost my mind, you know? Doing an Iron Maiden cover? I mean, I just got to pinch myself sometimes, you know?
Well, one of the first pieces that I remember you doing... I won't embarrass you. It was a Clint Eastwood black and white thing.
Yeah, I know exactly what you're talking about.
Josie Wales or whatever?
Yeah, it was a pencil piece that I'd done. I think, yeah, because I was kind of I showed my work in the shop when I worked. So I'd have, like, new pieces laying around, or, you know, I was doing science fiction shows at the time throughout the Midwest, and so I'd print to sell at the shows, and did I ever start at the bottom. But, you know, I think you get an appreciation of what it means to find some success when you've had to start that way. I mean, everybody does, right?
Sure.
But, I mean, some guys are so good that they kind of leapfrog a lot of steps, and, you know, consequently, I think you miss out on a lot of adventures, you know, because that process of getting from point A to point B, it's such a ride, man. I mean, it's a pretty special thing. And I mean, I'm talking start at the bottom, you know, like working in games,
yes,
role playing games and, you know, up to doing film posters. I mean, that's a long, long way.
No, and it was fun being in, you know, the shop and hearing that, oh yeah, Bradstreet's got a piece in this sci-fi magazine and it, you know, different little things like that. But let's talk about, like, as you say, you know, you started in role-playing games. There was that store or that business, Downtown Normal.
Oh, you mean Game Designers Workshop.
Yeah. Did you work for them?
Definitely. Yeah, that's where I started. That was where my first published work was. The way I got into that was, do you remember Dreamf?
Sure, absolutely.
Dreef was a comic store that we used to go to where Lloyd was there, the psycho cowboy.
Oh, Lloyd.
He could have been a Vertigo character. Really?
You know, I was just about to say the same thing. Lloyd, that guy needs, I mean, that guy's got to be in a movie, you know?
Like, yeah.
Some characterization of that guy is going to find its way to the surface with me at some point. But, I actually ran into Lloyd. I'm getting way off the point. But I actually ran into Lloyd one night, like about 10 years ago, way removed from when he used to own the shop. I was at Schnucks. I was at the supermarket,
okay.
2 o'clock in the morning, and I parked my car, and I got out, and there's this guy sleeping in a pickup truck next to me, and it's Lloyd. I was like, oh, my God.
This is good.
Anyway.
No, we have
funny,
a don't,
funny to you and I.
No, I was going to say, Word Balloon has a healthy Central Illinois subscription rate, so I think that's fine. You know, and it's been fun as a fan to watch your career evolve. So, Dreef got you to game designers?
Well, you know, in a sense. Lloyd permitted me to come in on a Saturday and set up at a table and lay my portfolio out. And when people would come into the shop to look at the artwork, or I'm sorry, to shop at the comics, they'd get to, you know, meet this guy who drew. I met this guy named Cliff Van Meter who did the same kind of stuff. He was a comic book artist, but he wasn't, you know, working for any major publishers. He was independent. And I made friends with this guy, and he introduced me to a cat named Steve Venters, and Steve Venters was a painter. He did Twilight 2000 for Game Designers Workshop, and he also did BattleTech for FASA, and he worked with Mayfair. But he was also one of the few guys in the country that does official paintings for the Air Force museums. So his real thing was he painted these big pieces of aircraft, you know, like F-4s over Vietnam laying napalm.
Wow.
Just unbelievable stuff. And so, yeah, I met Steve, and Steve, you know, he was getting to the point where he was growing weary of doing the interiors on Twilight 2000, and so he offered, he wanted me to do a tryout, and he liked the results, and he said, all right, it's yours. You know, he took me into Game Designers Workshop, they saw my stuff, they said, yeah, that's great, and then I became the regular artist on Twilight 2000. That was where I got my foot in the door.
Wow.
And then that led to FASA and working on BattleTech, Renegade Legion, and finally Shadowrun, which really is the thing that put me on the map.
Was it Shadowrun where you were working with Alex Ross or in the same realm as
yeah.
Ross?
And yeah, that's... we worked on the same book. And, you know, it's funny. Alex knows this. It's a pretty funny story. Alex and I have been friends for a long time. In fact, a lot of people think we're brothers or we're twins or, hey, it's like we were both losing our hair at the same time. We both had long hair. And, you know, people would just, you know, I was a little lighter back in those days. But, yeah, Alex had done these pieces for Shadowrun. His artwork was already done. He did, like, I think 8 illustrations for Shadowrun. And he was using Duo Shade Board, and he was working over movie stills. And he was kind of subtly reworking them.
Mm-hmm.
So, but he was using very obvious reference. So at that time, neither one of us were shooting our own reference.
Okay.
But the stuff was so strong that I felt like I have to up the ante here for myself. I have got to compete with this. It inspired me to, on Twilight 2000, I did pencil renderings over photographs. And I would take, you know, like a guy from this picture and then take another picture and stick that guy in the same picture and then do a background from a third picture. And I'd create these illustrations from 3 or 4 different photo references.
Okay.
But it was all working over photos on multimedia vellum, which is a semi-transparent drawing film that takes pencil really well. You know, and I toyed with using that style, like using that to work from photographs and then do stuff in black and white line art, but I'd never really gotten far with it until Shadowrun. And that's where I really started to kind of, that's actually where I created the process that I still use to this day. But at that time I was a lot rougher around the edges. You know, I was not refined as an artist. Which consequently, I mean, it's still fun to go back and look at that stuff because there's so much energy in it, you know.
Mm-hmm.
There was a lot of passion in that work, and even though it wasn't tooled into this kind of thing that I've brought it to after 20 years, or I guess not 20 years, it was about 1989 when I started working on Shadowrun, so about 18 years ago.
Well, close enough. Wow. Has the upgrades in technology made what you do easier?
Yeah, certainly. I mean, when I first started doing my own stuff, I was using a Pentax K1000 and having to go to the Daily Vedette dark room to process my shots because I had buddies that worked there. I'd just find whatever dark room I could get into.
Mm-hmm.
Then I had bought an enlarger from, do you know Kevin Strandberg? He's an art and photography teacher at Illinois Wesleyan.
No, and that's right. You went to Wesleyan. I went to Illinois State, so go ahead.
No, I went to State, too.
I just
dropped out. But I met Strandberg through some series of events, and I bought an enlarger from him. He had, like, six of these Besseler enlargers.
Okay.
So I bought my own enlarger, set up my own darkroom down in my basement, and started doing stuff that way with the Pentax K1000 for the longest time. So when I have to, like, create a shot that I'm going to generate into a cover, it would be a series of different photos, all shot to size. You know, I'd have a loose sketch down on my paper, and I'd stick the paper down underneath the enlarger to kind of judge how big I was going to, you know, make my shot.
Sure.
So it was this real, you know, like pieced together, like archaic way of doing it, and it was very laborious or laborious, as they say. Now, with the advent of computers, I still didn't really play with Photoshop much other than just to scan my photos in. I didn't have a digital camera or anything like that for the longest time. So I went from shooting my own stuff in black and white and processing it in my own darkroom to shooting stuff in color, black and white, whatever, getting it processed at a third party, scanning that stuff, resizing that stuff, and that saved me a ton of work. When I got into digital SLR, it quicken that process even more because now I can just go right to the computer with imagery.
That's cool.
So it's had a huge impact. Also a huge impact in terms of the way I compose a piece because now I can just composite out these figures of
sure.
these characters that I'm going to use and I can move them around with other elements and I can sit there. I mean, that's one of the most enjoyable parts of the job for me is to play with the composition and refine it to the version that I'm going to then draw.
I noticed on your most recent blog entry, and I've been enjoying your work on Sandman Mystery Theater, the new covers.
Rock and Roll Jack.
Is that part of that, you know, now even more freer a use of composition and what you're trying to do?
Well, you know, around about the time that I got this Punisher movie poster gig, it forced me to become, in effect, a photo retouch guy, okay? Now, I'm a graphic designer by nature. That's kind of, even when I couldn't draw, even when my skills weren't refined as an illustrator, I always had a good sense of graphic design and composition. So those have always been strengths of mine. So probably my major strengths. So
okay.
When it came time to do that kind of work, I found that I took to it like a fish to water. I was like, okay, so now I'm just, there's no illustration involved. It's creating this one sheet based off these photos. And retouching it so that it looks kind of like artwork without being so photographed. I mean, it's still a photo, but you do stuff to it so that it takes the edge off that.
Sure.
And what I do, and this is what I did on the Sandman Mystery Theater covers, was 90% of that stuff was photo-based. There are some illustrated elements in there, but they're silhouette elements.
Okay.
Things of that nature. But everything else is straight photo. What I do is I blend it with hand-painted textures that I filter over things. And I mean, it's a process that I don't even know that I could begin to explain. You'd almost have to just watch and kind of see it unfold. But what I try to do is not have it look like a photo. I mean, I don't know if that's a good way to describe it. Make it look like something more than a photo. That's kind of more along the lines of what I mean. You know, you look at that, I don't know if you've seen the Sandman Mystery Theater 5 cover.
I did.
But that's where I kind of, the number 4 cover and the number 5 cover, you know, after number 1 was pretty photo-based, I'm really happy with that cover. The second one, I played around with more, and I really liked it when I did it, but it doesn't hold up as well for me.
Okay.
Because it's still too photo-based for me. The third one is kind of starting to take the ball and run. The fourth one is, in my eyes, a complete success. It's a different animal. It's photographic, but it's way beyond that.
Okay.
And then the fifth one is kind of the culmination of everything I learned doing the first four.
That's really cool. And that's
so. And they wanted photo covers, photo retouch covers, a la the first Sandman series. And so when I kind of threw this stuff at them, they were just like, "Whoa, this is, we weren't even expecting this." So it was very successful. Karen really loved that stuff too. Karen and Richard Bruner. And that was, you know, Richard Bruner was one of the original photo artists on the first book. So
yeah.
It was like, you know, I gotta do my man proud.
It's really cool. And
I say Richard Bruner. I meant Richard Bruning.
Yes, of course. You know, and it's funny because this guy is a painter that I'm about to mention, but it reminded me of a lot of what David Mack does, you know, with Strictly Paint, because he's mixing media as well in a lot of his interiors and stuff. And there just seems to be some sort of kinship there.
Yeah, David's got, he's got some Sienkiewicz in him.
Yes.
You know, the way he mixes media is kind of like what Sienkiewicz does. And not by any means are they derivative of each other. But, David really kind of plays with everything. And, he's a very dynamic artist. And David's a good guy, too. I love Dave.
Now, based on what you've done with Sandman, I'm curious. I remember a few years ago they came out with, and I think it was Vertigo, they came out with an Al Fumetti book. And with what you're doing, and you know, Mark Miller was talking about doing a project with Marvel with photographs and stuff. Would you ever consider doing like a full, for lack of a better word, Fumetti style book like that?
Well, that's interesting. It's very interesting. But I mean, for me, it would almost be like, oh wait, I don't get to go through the process that I love the most, which is taking those photos and then turning them into artwork, turning them into this different animal. And it's certainly within my capabilities to do something like that and to kind of like fashion something that would really work like that.
Yeah, reflect that style.
Yeah. I'd want to do it in a way that was very dark and, you know, it would depend on the subject matter, right? But
sure.
The idea of it is intriguing. But I'd hate to think, you know, like in the back of my mind, it's like I'd hate to think I went out and I shot all this stuff and it turned out this good and then I didn't get to turn it into artwork. You know what I mean?
Sure.
You know, and you know, the thing I love about Mark Miller is that he's one of these guys that, you know, I have my detractors, and it's this whole photoreal thing. Oh, I just trace. Oh, I just, you know what I mean?
I do.
It's pretty tiresome. And what most of these people don't understand is the process that I go through to turn it into something else. There's a long story to this, and there's other reasons why the stuff that I've been doing over the last couple of years seems more photographic, but I wouldn't say that it's necessarily down to the part that I'm doing. I work with a guy named Grant Goliash, and Grant tends to be as meticulous as his reference. And so what Grant brings to the party sometimes, which I think is, I'm trying to get away from it right now, is in the color, making it look too photographic in the color, where he needs to just pull back. Like I said, I'm trying to get him to do this right now because I'm not satisfied with the way stuff is. I don't need my comic covers to look like movie posters.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the problem that some of these purists have. They're like, well, first of all, Bradstreet just traces, and second of all, it doesn't do anything for me because it's not dynamic. And whatever, I mean, it hurts me sometimes when I hear comments like that, but I know the truth. You know, I get back to the point where I'm in the creative process and I go, well, these guys are just full of shit. And I have no idea.
What goes into it?
Yeah, what goes into it. And what I bring to the party, in not only in the pencil and what I'm doing essentially is I'm pulling things out of that photograph when I pencil it, and I'm changing what's there, and I'm re-rendering it. I'm kind of bringing something from my mind's eye to it. It's not just a simple tracing exercise. There really is so much more to it. And I think another thing that these guys don't like, nobody really had a problem with me until I started to get rid of my feather lines and tried to simplify my black line stuff. And when I did that, I got less illustrative. Well, I mean, I'm still incredibly detailed and illustrative, but I started changing everything that used to be feather lines into textures. And I guess that can have the tendency to make things look a little bit more photographic as well. It seems like on the outside that there's not as much craft there.
Mm-hmm.
But if anything, there's probably more because I'm trying to figure out how to take this and turn it into this and have it do the same thing. Right now, I mean, I just turned out this Punisher cover that is just, I went back to my old style and for this cover, and I want to kind of go back there a little bit more. I kind of feed off of whatever I'm working on at the time.
Okay.
And I haven't inked a book in a long time, but generally when I ink a book, those things that I do while I'm inking a book show themselves up in my own work. When I was inking Chris Warner, I picked up tricks and I brought it to my own stuff, and it becomes this mishmash of, you know, little idiosyncrasies that Chris has or little things that I try to do in the inks. And it's something and it makes me think in a different way. It makes me think I could go in this direction with the piece. Now, I just got back to work, you know, inking Lee Bermejo. I picked up little things that I brought to, you know, inking his stuff, and it found its way into my work. It's like I kind of bring stuff. That's a good way to describe this. It's not a leech thing. It's not like I'm stealing, you know, anyone's style or anything like that. But it's like when you are inking someone, you're forced to kind of think in a different way because you're trying to, you know, carve these inks over this other person's style. Now, Lee and I have a very similar sensibility, so that was not a stretch by any stretch of the imagination.
Right.
I'm inking Jim Daly right now on Bad Planet, and consequently, I'm having to do a lot of finishes in ink, so I'm doing a lot more work than I might normally do inking a guy. And so it's forcing me to think in these different ways. Like I'm spotting folds, and I'm trying to think old EC style and Creepy and Eerie and Richard Corbin and Bernie Wrightson and all these guys, and I'm trying to kind of bring this kind of a look to the book. And then it just permeated into my own work. I had to do, you know, it's like I shot this cover, and I'm like, I have to do this way. And actually, you can check that out on my other site. It's that black and white image at the top of the page on the pick section of my page. But you know, I poured over. I sat around looking at Frankenstein for like 2 weeks. Bernie Wrightson's Frankenstein, and those kind of books, those kind of illustrations, just they inspire you so much because it's like, how did he do this?
Yeah,
you know what I mean? It's
absolutely.
Like, it's just such an incredible body of work. And I just digested the hell out of it. And you look at that Punisher piece and you'll see Bernie Wright's The Frankenstein moves in there, although I wasn't using a pen. I wasn't using the gelat nib, the magical Frankenstein gelat nib. I was using a brush on it, but I think it still comes across a little bit. And it's my kind of homage to Bernie in a way. And it really is a throwback. It looks like something I might have done 10 years ago. You know, but the thing I noticed is that I haven't worked in that style in a long time. And when I went back to it, I didn't suffer at all from the layoff. In fact, I found out that working the way I have been has made me more technically accurate. So it's a lot cleaner than my old stuff. Someone looked at it and they said it looked like Brian Boland, and I never get that because I'm like, it doesn't make me think of Brian Boland a bit because I'm such a fan of Brian's, I could spot his stuff a million miles away. But it's not me trying to emulate Brian Boland, and it's not me trying to do anything Boland-esque. It always confuses me when someone like makes a comment like that, but I guess it's not as, I hate to sound pretentious, but it's not as informed of an opinion, I guess. It's not as knowledgeable. You know, as a non-artist telling me this, too, as a fan telling me this. So
absolutely. No, and that's...
Not that there's anything wrong with a fan, but they just can't know artists like other artists know artists.
No,
you know
I can appreciate... Oh, Tim, file my David Mack comment in that
yeah.
place. No, and you're right. And it's funny because I always find difficulty sometimes talking to artists because you guys do. You guys speak your own language and recognize tells within each other of style and influence that I think the average layman can't figure out because you guys have a much more informed base of knowledge that you're, you know, going for.
Yeah, you're exposed by it and you're constantly absorbing it, you know. I mean, I went through a period where, I don't know, for a couple of years where I didn't really look at anybody else's artwork. I didn't buy any comics. I didn't look at anybody else's artwork. I just got into what I was doing. And I found that at the end of that was fun. And I didn't really do it on purpose. I just kind of gravitated that way. There was no agenda. But, you know, I kind of recently, I've just been really kind of very, I've felt very, like, inclined to, you know, pick up Roy G. Krenkel books and Franklin Booth books and look at Alex Toth and look at all these things and just, you know, redigest this stuff now, you know, 10 years after I've owned the book and looked at it the first time. And I don't sit there ever with a book open of somebody else's stuff and try to ape it, you know.
Sure.
But you absorb it when you look at it, and then it has the chance, you have the opportunity to let that filter through and manifest itself in any way that kind of makes it work for you. I like to think like Alex thinks sometimes, and that's breaking everything down to shapes and breaking everything down to black and white and a really high contrast style. And, you know, it's like Tony Harris once said to me, he goes, man, no one I know has the balls to do like this badass guy. And then his face is all black, completely in shadow, and the only thing that's poking out is his nose, you know? And I was like, hey, that felt really good. That was like a really neat compliment, you know?
Yeah. What I always love and what pops out to me is your love of weapons. And, you know, I'm not asking as an undercover agent for the ATF, but I'm wondering where where did this come from?
I have no illegal weapons.
That's good.
Let me just be frank about that. All my guns are registered. And actually, I don't even, you know, I have a couple of working guns that are registered, like my Ruger Super Blackhawk,
okay.
44, which is, you know, it's like the one handgun I ever really bought, working revolver, you know, like firearm that I ever really bought, because it's a single action pistol.
Okay.
You have to cock it to fire it, so it's a lot safer to have around than any other kind of firearm.
I mean,
pulling that hammer back ain't easy. Yeah, it's my home safety weapon. If anyone ever comes climbing through my window, they're gonna hear that thing click back.
Gotcha.
I won't have to shoot anyone. I won't even have to shoot a hole through my roof to warn them. All I have to do is click that sucker back and go, I'm holding a .44 at your head. But, God, I don't even like to think of that. But, I live vicariously through it, John. It's something that was born of my, you know, male testosterone-filled imagination, you know, as a child.
Absolutely.
Not that children are stuffed with testosterone, but you know what I mean.
I do.
It's like, for me, all my heroes, all the things that I loved when I was a kid growing up were, you know, like Steve McQueen movies and, spaghetti westerns and Mad Max and The Road Warrior and, you know, Blade Runner, stuff like that.
Yep.
And all those protagonists are, you know, it's like the childhood fantasy. You know, you're playing guns with your friends. You're playing war. You're playing western, or you're doing whatever. Guys and guns. Someone should do a book about it. The male fascination with firearms.
Sure.
But No, I mean, the only reason I do the things that I do with the firearms and the stuff is, A, because I'm doing photo rep. Well, even before that, I was doing accurate guns. What am I saying? I've always kind of had a penchant for it. But that's only because I wanted to see it done the right way. I woke up one morning, I think, this didn't really happen, but it's like I woke up one day and I went, that doesn't look like a gun. What is that? That just looks terrible. And so, consequently, if it's even, you know, whether it's a actual working, you know, Lee Enfield Mark 303, you know, constructed in 1911 by the Australian government, or, you know, some kind of retrofitted, futuristic gun that's built off of something that's realistic, I just absolutely love to make sure that stuff's accurate. You know, the guy that does really great guns in comics is Mike Golden.
Yes.
I mean, his Vietnam era stuff, or his anything he does with web gear, or, you know, like big machine guns on tripods, these big Vulcan Gatling guns that straddle the side of these choppers. I mean, no one does it like Golden. It's so accurate. And if you really look at it, so simple the way he does it. It's just amazing. I was looking at one of his Jurassic Park portfolios the other day. Someone had brought this thing by, and it's like, you know, this dinosaurs versus technology kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's a lot of, like, you know, army guys and helicopters and machine guns and craziness, you know, against pterodactyls and shit like that. It's just absolutely gorgeous, you know, and of course all the stuff he did for the Nom. I think everybody just flipped out when that stuff came out.
Oh, yeah. Would Westerns be something? I don't recall you doing Westerns. Have you done, I mean, I know you did the Clint Eastwood thing back in the day.
The only thing I've done, well, I've done some card game illustrations and stuff like that in the last 10 years, but the only thing I've really done kind of mainstream with Westerns is I did a cover for Jonah Hex. And I have to tell you that, you know, when Vertigo comes out and they do a thing like El Diablo, mm-hmm. or they do a thing like The Loveless,
mm-hmm.
which, you know, that's Marcello Frusen.
Yes.
I would never want to, you know, jump a coattail on that. But when they did El Diablo, I could have strangled Will Dennis for not offering me the covers for that. And I don't know whether it's someone thinks that, well, I'm too photographic to pull off something that's period. But I guess I'm going to have to do a couple of period pieces, and thankfully Red Sky Diary is along those lines.
Very cool.
To convince people that I can work in that style in that, and just use more textures and things to kind of give it that kind of more period look. But I would absolutely be a dream job to do some kind of like spaghetti, what, El Diablo kind of cover gig.
Sure.
You know?
No,
and
absolutely.
I'm hopefully going to get a crack at another Jonah Hex one too. You want to reference it, if you go to my regular website, where my regular TypeHat blog is,
mm-hmm.
go there, and in the covers and illustrations gallery, I do believe it's in there.
Okay.
You want a quick reference. But, I did the whole thing in sepias and, you know, went for this throwback kind of style with it even too, and I think it really works. I mean, it definitely does breathe Western. It's something I really didn't even use any textures on. I mean, I almost, like, if I did it today, I'd probably do it completely differently, even though I only did this thing, like, 8 months ago, a year ago.
Okay. Let's talk about Red Sky Diary, because you mentioned it, and I've seen what you've got up so far on your MySpace page for it. And would you describe the project for people who might be curious?
I was talking to Eric Redd today, who was the screenwriter of the original Hitcher, Near Dark. Cohen and Tate. I've recently gotten into contact with him because I'm working on a movie poster for him, and he wanted to know about Red Sky Diary, and so I kind of broke it down to him, and he, God bless him, he came up, this is something I'm still kind of fleshing out, this epic story.
Okay.
And he had at least six great ideas for me to kind of take somewhere with this, like ways that I can make this story better. And God love him. But we talked about it for like 3 hours this afternoon. So this is really fresh in my head. Gallows is the main character of Red Sky Diary. Gallows is a pseudonym. His real name is rather hard to pronounce because he's of Mongolian descent. In the scope of the book, he would be the modern-day incarnation of a clan of vampire hunters. And I use the word vampire loosely. I call the creatures in this book the Mudir. Which is an Arabic word for demon.
Okay.
Because back in the time of Kublai Khan, which is where the story, you know, really starts with Gallo's ancestor, people didn't know what the hell a vampire was, you know. They could only describe it like, it's a beast, it's a demon, it's a whatever. And I'm not talking about these are Anne Rice-type vampires. They're, for the most part, feral, Nosferatu, rat-like creatures. There are some permutations that are a little more organized and a little less rat-like, but no, there's none of those cute, crimped French romantic vampires in this thing, except for possibly one character who's just a complete badass and is probably going to look pretty cool in the book, and chicks will probably dig. But he's not, you know, he doesn't do snuff, and he doesn't, you know, he's completely villainous. So they're the main villains, the main bad things in this thing are vampires, because basically Gallows and his clan, firstborn male child, trains from infancy to become the next in line hunter. So they take over the mantle when they're physically of age. A pretty good way to kind of get a sense of this is to go to that MySpace page, which is just that MySpace, it's a / Red Sky Diary. And what I've got on there is a little bit of text. It doesn't give you the whole picture, but it gives you enough idea of what this character is to get a sense of what an iconic character I think I have here. So So Red Sky Diary, just to kind of sum it all up, as it takes too long to explain, is a concept that I dreamed up around 1993. And you'll like this. It was spawned off of, I did this book with Tim Truman called Dragon Chang.
Mm-hmm.
And my best friend Joel was my model for Dragon Chang. I had done a couple illustrations for Dragon Chang that Tim ended up making, like, the trade paperback cover and on one of the illustrations. And then, of course, I was inspired by that stuff, so I started to strike out on my own with the concept. And I threw this idea at Tim of doing a young Dragon Chang book, kind of a prequel.
Okay.
And having him riding this motorcycle and stuff like this. So I came up with this whole thing based, you know, used Joel, had these flash goggles. I came up with this whole angle on a young Dragon Chang thing. But when I realized that was probably not going to go anywhere, I kind of slowly but surely turned him into my own character. And one day I sat in front of a drawing I'd just done in 1993. Probably the best thing I'd done to that point in my life. Thing that I was like, I have to make something out of this. I have to come up with a story. So I made a couple of Xeroxes of the piece, and I started just scribbling notes all over them. And, you know, just creating this character just by making, by making notes and creating a history and a timeline. So I kind of hatched this whole thing out in its broadest strokes. It's changed certainly a lot since that first day, but yeah, he was kind of born out of Dragon Chang. I actually used some of the illustrations as pieces in this book called Dark Conspiracy for Game Designers Workshop.
Okay.
You know, they were still kind of conceptual. I think one of them even is like a cyborg, but it's Gallows, you know, it's like where Gallows started.
That's really cool.
But it wasn't until that drawing I did in 93, so it was like 89 through 93, I'd been toying with this character, and then in 93 I kind of figured out that it was going to be Red Sky Diary. I sat down and thought of the title, came up with the whole backstory of, and the reason Diary is in the title is because each of these generations of these vampire hunters, the Mudir hunters, keep journals. And so they're archived, you know, they're all stored away in safe houses all the way around, and it's full of information, like from like weapons that they designed and notes that they made on covens in certain regions. It's full of, you know, like all this research and so there's this, you know, like this incredible tomb of journals and diaries that stretch back, you know, almost 700 years.
To the first guy.
Of notes, yeah. And I almost thought, you know, one time I was like, if I do this as a comic, if I can do this in illustrated form, that I want to try to break the tradition of the sequential panels with little excerpts from the diary and actually draw the pages of the diary where, you know, you're like a naturalist, okay? When these guys were like naturalists, they'd be studying this coven, they'd make sketches. And so there's sketches and diagrams and there's plans for, you know, like weapons that they made and it's crazy shit, man.
That's great.
It's just, it could be so cool.
It's got a Phantom feel to it. It's got a Lee Falk Phantom kind of legacy feel
to
it.
No, I never really knew about the Phantom, but I discovered this thing about the Phantom about 5 years ago. And I went, oh, wow, that sounds like I'm ripping that. I had no idea.
Okay.
Yeah. And I was like, I've got to figure out a way to change this up a little bit so it doesn't smack so much of that. But, yeah, when I found that out, I was like, God damn it, man, there are no original ideas.
Well, and I don't point it out to, you know, no,
you're exactly right. I'm glad you did bring it up. I seriously am because that really did. I was like, God damn it, what am I going to do? I've got to figure out a way to kind of make this not seem like that so much. And I was in love with the ideas, you know, so it's
sure.
Tough. It's like, you know, like having children and having to, you know, kill them off one by one so that one can survive, you know.
Well, we're gonna have the evolution of Gallows from that original piece and what you've got, and also I'll lead people to the MySpace page because you really have to check it out. And remember that Tim is a great, you know, illustrator, pen and ink and pencil, as well as what he does with photography. And I think you'll see good evidence of that in some of these early conceptual drawings. It's nice to see, man.
Yeah, it's funny, you know, a lot of these guys that will, you know, take a pot shot at me once in a while, they're always like, well, how come you don't put your sketches up there? I'm like, because I kind of, it's not that I skip the process, but I don't, you know, it's like I almost freeform when I'm in a photo shoot anymore.
Okay.
I have a mental picture of the pose I want in my head, you know, pretty much. And why do I need to sketch it out if I'm just going to shoot it? You know what I mean?
It's sure. Like,
but, you know, a lot of times I will sketch it out, just sketch my initial ideas and stuff like that. But I never need to make it very finished because I don't really need much there to kind of go, you know, to use another analogy I used before, go to point A, from point A to point B. And so consequently, my sketches are very sketchy, you know, they're very
sure.
Loose. They're very, you know, like, here's a balloon head, here's a stick figure. Well, not always that rough, but all I need to do is kind of just get an idea of the composition or the body language and the angle and stuff like that. So yeah, I did a lot of that stuff when I was younger, but it's like, you know, in the last 5-10 years, I've just gotten more and more away from it. But they are fun to look at. I mean, I always say, you know what, pick up Maximum Black, my art book. That came out in 98.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not trying to sell it. I'm just saying, don't buy it by any means. Go into a shop, find a copy.
Literally pick it
look
up.
Look through it. And you'll see the sketches and you'll see, you know, like the early stages of the progression of what I go through when I'm trying to create a cover or, you know, do comics. And I have, you know, like sketchbooks full of thumbnails and shit like that. And it's like, just because I don't show it means I don't do it. I mean, I don't understand that, but. Whatever.
I like
people
your new...
can be misinformed and judgmental. That's fine. They're going to be like that anyway.
I like your new stuff on what you've been doing with Cal McDonald for Criminal McCrob. With it's nice to see Tom as Cal, Tom Jane.
And Tom is Cal.
That's cool.
Tom was made to play Cal.
Absolutely, man. And I asked Niles that. I'm like, you know, is that, you know, are you shocked that, you know, really? He came to life for you. I mean, that's great. I mean, and he was an interesting character and pretty much was Tom before I think anyone would put two and two together. But it's nice that Tom really does personify who Cal is.
He really does, you know, and it's so effortless for him, you know. And maybe that's because it's a little close to home, who knows. But I don't mean that in any crazy way. Like, Tom's not a big drug taker, believe me. I'm like, hey, Tom, you got any painkillers? He's like, I can't do that stuff, man. I'm like, okay, damn you. But no, I got to tell you that Criminal Macabre, I've never had as much fun doing comics. You know what I'm going to do? I'm going to send you a photo rough right now.
Oh, thanks, man.
Of the piece that I'm working on next.
Great.
And this will illustrate to you, and it'll illustrate to the people that hear this thing when it comes out.
Yes,
it'll be Criminal Macabre number 6. I have never had so much fun doing a comic in my entire life, and the reason why is because, you know, when I was working for Vertigo and doing Hellblazer,
mm-hmm.
absolutely loved doing Hellblazer.
I
loved the character, loved the process. They were pretty hands-off until Will Dennis left. And for some reason, about the time this editor came in, I started getting art directed a lot more. And I think that initially I was like, this guy's art directing me because he thinks that's part of his job. He thinks that because he's the editor, he has to art direct, whether it really needs it or not. And, you know, listen, I'm not ever going to complain about art direction, but it's got to be something I understand. I mean, this guy would just, he would say stuff and I'd be like, you know what? You didn't even know what you're talking about. I don't mean that, you know, I don't mean to smack him or anything, but I'm just saying, I know what I'm doing. And it's kind of one of those things where if it's not broke, don't fix it.
Sure.
And I am not afraid to be challenged. I am not afraid of anybody that I feel knows what they're talking about asking me to do something different or something more. But when it's just, for the most part, just needless art direction, I have no respect for that. And I was getting it more and more and more on that title, and I was like, wow, this is really becoming a chore. And I just felt in the back of my mind something was wrong. And it wasn't too long after that, maybe 3 or 4 months. Yeah, they made the decision a month before, and they just couldn't figure out a way to tell me. They were like, we don't have a good excuse. You know, Tim's doing a good job on this book. The fans love him. You know, I wasn't part of the problem, but what happened was is that Karen Berger God love her. I'm not slamming Karen. She's great. I love her to death. But she wanted to, she was like, we need it to be more in your painted style. I started doing all my color on the computer.
Okay.
And she really wanted more of a painted style. And I tried and tried and tried with Grant and on covers that I colored myself to do more of a painted style digitally. But apparently I couldn't do it to her satisfaction. And that's one, it's not the reason, but it's one of the reasons that contributed to me being asked to leave the book. So it was really hard for them to tell me.
Sure.
And when they did, I was a little taken aback, but I also felt like I've seen this coming. I mean, I had to kind of pry it out of the editor. I was like, something's up. Why don't you tell me what's going on? And that's when he told me. So I didn't feel bad. I didn't feel slighted. I didn't feel any less important because I was losing this job that I coveted. But it was disappointing. Now, of course, you immediately look for something to replace it. Well, I built up a good rate on Hellblazer, so that was my bread and butter every month for 7 years.
Sure.
And with that gone, I didn't panic, but I was definitely, I was a little worried. I was like, what am I going to get to replace this? You know, jobs don't grow on trees. I have to find something that's going to work. And here comes Cal McDonald. Steve Niles called me one day and he goes, listen, would you be interested in doing covers for a Cal McDonald regular series? I was like, dude, I'd kill to do it. I almost want to use Denise Mina's quote. I'd eat my own guts to do it. That's a great quote. And what's happened on this thing is that I have total autonomy. Okay? Now, that can be a bad thing. That can very easily not always be a good thing, because you might find yourself spinning your wheels at some point if no one's kind of reining you in. But I'm having so much fun experimenting with this, and Steve and I said right off the bat, you know, we don't want to come at Criminal Macabre like a traditional comic book. Like, we don't care if every cover's different. We don't care if you do a different style once in a while. We don't care if you do a photo cover, you know. We just want you to do what you love to do, and we want you to just make it Cal. We want to make it breathe this book. So the editor is completely hands-off. She lets me and Steve just talk about concepts, and then Steve just, he's like happy with something that's completely ambiguous. Doesn't have to be anything that happens in the issue. If it's inspired by it, it's good enough.
I loved, and I told Steve this, the picture of Cal driving with monster's hand coming and the bald-headed monster in the back seat. And it's funny to learn that the bald-headed monster is, in fact,
Steve Niles.
Thank you.
Yeah. I tell you what, you know, I put a blurb on my website about this because I just get giddy like a schoolgirl whenever I talk about Criminal Macabre. So whenever I post a cover, I sometimes tell a little story about how we did it. And it's fun because when we did a movie poster for a teaser poster for In the Blood, one of Steve's projects that we had at Lionsgate, I made Steve dress up in the werewolf costume. When, you know, Steve's always there, so it's like he's that extra body, so he always has to do the grunt work. He has to put on these sweaty, slimy prosthetics, you know. And, you know, it's fun for me because, yeah, you know what, I could just draw a gnarled hand, but it's not going to be as realistic in the rest of the shot as the real thing. So luckily, you know, and I don't know if Steve told you about this, we have a good friend, and I've known him for years, a guy by the name of Greg Nicotero from K&B Effects Group. And every time we want to do a Cal shoot, I call Greg and I go, hey, Greg, can we come down and pilfer some stuff in the studio? He goes, yeah, sure, come on down. So we come down, open up the trunk, walk through the studio, arms, legs, severed heads, masks, like prosthetics. It's just, we just have a ball. And then we turn it into stuff. We make stories. And that one, that Cal number 3 cover, that Criminal Macabre number 3 cover with the creature in the back seat reaching at Cal, unbeknownst to Cal, that's one of my favorite covers ever.
And Steve said that that's his car. That Cal's car is his car. That's awesome.
That's his smoke gray Nova. I can't remember the year of that car.
I think he said 73.
There you go, the 73 Nova.
I believe.
The cool thing I found... This is after I did the cover. I was reading the flavor text, the blurb on that particular issue, and it mentions the fact that Cal's car is haunted. That the former owner haunts the car. So I'm like, oh, that's cool, because it could either be the Nosferatu in the backseat.
Yes.
Or it could be the ghost of this guy, or it could just be some creep hanging out in the car.
Absolutely.
The cover for 5 that I did is the first issue of the story arc, Demon Baby. Now, there's no Demon Baby on the cover. And on the second issue, the one you're looking at, there's no Demon Baby on this cover either. It's not until the third issue we see the Demon Baby, which incidentally is Harlow Jane, Patricia Arquette and Tom's daughter.
Oh, wow.
And we shot this, like, you know what? I mean, the funny thing about this is I shot these pictures of Tom as Cal, like, 2 years ago, maybe almost three years ago. And he and Harlow was hassling us for a while, you know, like, okay, we had to kind of take a time out from the photo session because Harlow was in the room, and she was, like, 2 at the time. And so, you know, Tom's picking her up. Well, I continue to shoot pictures, and I've got this lid, all top lid, and we got, so there was this, a couple of shots that came out of that where I was like, oh my God, look at this. I sent it to Steve, and I'm like, look at this picture of Harlow. She looks like some kind of demon baby. And Niles goes, I got to write a story around this. So that's like the fun part of the creative process, when you can just do something completely by accident and then create something from it, you know?
That's really great. And is, you know, are you, how much are you participating in Raw Entertainment? How much is it, you know, the three of you guys?
Well, I have been made a partner, finally. At first I was the de facto art director and creative consultant. But it seemed like I was just as much involved as anyone else in there. In fact, I was doing a hell of a lot of work for nothing for a long time. Just because I wanted to. And because the project sounded fun, and I finally kind of just went to Tom and I said, listen, man, I said, I'd really like to be a partner if I could. And Tom was like, you are. What are you talking about? And I go, well, no one ever said anything. And he goes, no, definitely. If you want me to make it official, I'll fucking put out a blurb or something. But yeah, no, it's us, man. But in the initial stages of Raw, no, I got Tom and Steve together initially.
That's what I was going to ask. Okay.
That those guys just, you know, they live up in L.A. I'm down here in San Diego, so I'm kind of disconnected a little bit when it comes to certain things, taking meetings and things like that. And so they put together this development deal, he and Steve, with Lionsgate. And that's fine. I mean, they were doing their thing. I mean, I had no problem with it. But when we started working on the Raw comics and then Tom, you know, offered, he wants me to art direct this movie that he's going to direct. And then hopefully he's got 2 films that he wants to direct coming up. And on the second one, I'm hoping to be production designer on. So
that's great.
Trying to, like, take steps, right? And so just recently in the last month, they made me a partner. So it's the trimoverate of evil now. To answer your question, I would be the creative. If I had to have a division, I'd be creative division. So I art direct, graphic design, whatever we need, you know, like we need to, you know, generate stuff up for movie posters or for things like The Lurkers or In the Blood.
Sure.
That falls to me to either do myself if I think I can bring something to it or find the guy that can do it. And Steve, I should say Tom, and Steve helps out a lot too with this because he knows a lot of artists, but Tom really loves to do that. Tom loves to go find artists, go surfing and find guys. Now, at the beginning, wasn't real good at it.
Okay.
He would suggest guys, and I'd go look at their stuff, and I'd go, Tom, no way.
Okay.
You're insane. And but he's learned a lot in those kind of situations. I've learned a lot from him. It's really, you know, I don't know what other way to put it other than to say it's like 3 really good friends all having a ball doing what they love and coming together to kind of put all their powers together into one power and make stuff happen.
That's excellent. Well, and I was commenting to Steve in my earlier interview with him that it seems like Tom is almost this Forrest Gump-like, you know, comic fan that is just like, hey, Bernie Wrightson, can you do this for me? You know, and I don't know if that's true or not, but that's kind of how it appeared to me when I interviewed Tom last summer about Bad Planet. and just the guys that he was rattling off that, oh, you're not going to believe what we got for this. And I'm like, yeah, how the hell are you getting these guys? Like, well, I've been a fan of these guys for all this time. And it's like, hi, it's the Punisher. Can you do my comic book? And it's like, sure.
Well, you know, when Tom kind of first got this idea to do comics, and he was doing Punisher, and in interviews he'd be talking about how he's a big comic fan, you know, that no one really gets what he's talking about. Tom is as much of a comic fan as me, as you, as anybody. Tom's got a collection. I mean, dude's been collecting since he was 6 years old. He had a complete run of Mad magazines. This is before he made it in Hollywood, dude.
Wow.
This is way before that. Creepy, Eerie, the EC comics. Tom is a hardcore fan of comics. And I think there was a misconception when Steve was first starting to do comics that, no, he's just this guy that thinks that he's gonna, you know, he says he's a comics fan, just doing comics as a way to kind of build, intellectual properties to do movies. That's not even close. When he explained Bad Planet to me the first time, he's like, I don't even want to think about this as a movie. This is not the reason we're doing this. This is a comic. This is a comic first, and I don't care if it ever gets made into anything. I don't give a shit. It was all spawned off this dream that he had while he was hurting on painkillers. He got injured, and he was on painkillers. He had these weird dreams, and it blossomed into Bad Planet.
Very cool.
But he is hardcore, and he's a hardcore collector too. I mean, now that he's got the funds, he is getting that Heritage Auction House catalog, you know, and buying great stuff. And yeah, he loves his comics. Now, incidentally, his entire comic book collection, magazine collection, burned to the ground when his parents' house burned down about 6 or 7 years ago.
Harsh.
That hit him pretty hard.
That's too bad. That sucks.
No one died but his comics.
Oh, man.
But Tom's like a little kid. I almost want to send you another picture right now. He called me about 2 months ago, and he goes, would you mind if I came over and inked some pages or blacked some pages? I said, are you serious? He's like, yeah, I'd love to just sit around in the studio and just work on some pages. He's like, I can't draw anything, but I could at least black. I've got Tom Jane offering to black my pages. Grunt work at best, right? So 2 weeks ago, he got back from doing reshoots on Killshot up in Toronto.
Okay.
And he came down to the studio. And it was me and him and Jim Daly, the current artist on the book, sitting around in my studio all day until 6 o'clock in the morning, blacking pages. And this guy was like a kid in a candy store. He got into it so much. I mean, he was just absolutely giddy. And the really cool thing is he gained a whole new level of understanding of what it takes to do this stuff. I was telling Mark Schultz about it, and Schultz was like, wow, that's really cool.
Yeah.
That, you know, the publisher is, you know, Tom. Like,
yeah, really.
Well, you know, Mark had the same, you know, first impression of Tom. He thought, you know, maybe he's a little nuts. And, or you know, like, I don't know how serious he is about this, but if he's going to pay me this much, sure, I'll do it. But Mark found out very quickly that Tom is way more heady than people want to give him credit for. He is smarter. He is very intelligent.
That's cool.
Very, very intelligent and really knows what he wants. And with the whole Raw line, you know, we are going for these throwback books. That's the kind of stuff we want to do. And since that time, Mark has just kind of opened his heart to us too. And he's one of our guys. He's in our stable. We have Mark Schultz.
Yes, you do. A fine cover for Bad Planet, I should add, among other things, and also Alien Pig Farm 3000.
Well, so you saw the cover for number 3?
For Bad Planet?
Yeah.
Yes, I did, and in fact, you guys provided for our Word Balloon magazine, and I thank you profusely for that.
Well, that's an incredible cover, but I was actually referring to Alien Pig Farm. He and William Stout are sharing the art chores on that book, and those guys got into a pissing contest. it became, okay, Stout did his cover, and then Mark went, okay, Bill. And then he did this second cover, and, like tried to blow Stout away.
Those are the two I've seen.
Then Stout went, oh, I see how it is. And he turned out this just unbelievable cover for issue 3.
Okay.
Well, and Mark's like, oh, man. All right, buddy. Let's see what you think of this. And Mark, on the 4th issue, absolutely has blown everyone away. I'm not kidding. He channeled Frazetta. It looks like one of those old, incredible, black and white style Frazetta pieces.
How many? Is it 6 issues?
It's 4 issues.
It's only going to be 4 issues. Okay.
Bad Planet 6 of Pig Farm 4.
Okay. And Bad Planet's going to restart again with Jim in June?
Yeah. We initially talked about releasing it in May, but then we realized, this whole, we're doing a series about 14 pages of issue 3 are going to be in 3D.
Okay.
And to do that process, we hired Ray Zone, the original 3D master.
Wow.
To create the 3D on the book. And that's going to take some time. So we decided not to cramp ourselves too much, and we wanted to have, we don't want to, even come close to running the risk that we're going to miss a ship date. So we just said, all right, screw it. Let's just release it in June, and then we'll just make sure that we have copies of issue 3 in July for the show. So what's going to happen is Jim Daly and I have done a new cover for issue 1. So we're reissuing issue 1, and we're going to double ship it with issue 2 in the same month. So both those issues will come out in June.
Very cool.
In July, the 3D issue, and then up until September, up until October, when the 6th issue comes out. So yeah, I mean, there ain't nothing stopping it at this point. We learned a valuable lesson, and I tried to tell Tom, when we first started doing Bad Planet, that we should wait to solicit this book. Don't succumb to pressure that Image is putting on you to get this book out, because we really need about 3 months of lead time with the penciler.
Okay.
And, at the time, Tom was, he's financing this thing out of his own pocket. It's about $14,000 to do an issue of a book. So Tom was just thinking, I don't want to get in Dutch that much. I don't want to put that much on the line to, wait till all these 4 issues are done. I'm going to have, $40,000, $50,000, $60,000 out there with no return. And
right.
So from that standpoint, it made sense that he just wanted to try to, wade through it and get it done. But he was not prepared for the little things that happen.
Sure.
And the little things that happen are sometimes artists flake out on you, and sometimes they get sick. Anything happens to that guy that's penciling the book, that book ain't coming out.
Right. The wheels are off the wagon. Absolutely.
Yeah. And the thing is that, Lewis had some health problems, and he couldn't work, and we made a decision because we were so completely blown away by the stuff that Lewis was doing. He was doing the best stuff he's ever done, best stuff of his career on Bad Planet, and we just decided to stick with him. I appealed to Tom. I was like, listen, we're not Marvel here, okay?
Right.
We don't have to fire guys, and obviously we know the situation. So it's like we can't let the quarterback lose his job to injury.
Sure.
So we stuck it out with him for months, waiting for him to get better. And so the book had to go on hiatus. I mean, we missed the issue 2 shift date. We missed it. So the book, 1 issue came out.
Right.
Kiss of death, right?
Yeah.
Kiss of death. Everyone's like, you miss your shift date, right?
Right.
So I'm like, yeah, we can't. The book's dead. I mean, we can resurrect it, we can get it back on the ball, but, we're going to have to figure out a way to tell fans what happened. We've got to come clean. We've got to just tell people.
Sure.
And we just tell the truth. We should be fine, because no one's going to hold us responsible for sticking with the guy,
Right.
Because he was sick. So, Tom had to end up going to London to film Mutant Chronicles. Mm-hmm. He was gone for a while. The whole project was just dead for all intents and purposes. We knew we were going to get back on it, but it was just a question of, is Lewis going to come back, or you know, how much time can we afford to give him? And it just turned out that, you know, we finally realized that Lewis was not going to be able to come back and do the book. And so we finally, you know, we took a long time finding a guy. And when we finally found him, we kind of got the ball rolling again. Of course, he's worked out so well. Jim Daly's just been pumping out pages. And I mean, he's two issues ahead of me.
That's great.
The bastard. And now my work's cut out for me. You would not believe the crap that's gone on for us to be able to do this book, but finally it's on the right track, and it's going to come out in June.
And we'll pause there for part one. Part two coming up later on this week. More information, and certainly we'll get into talk about The Punisher and other projects that Tim has going on and the various things that Tim has come across in his vast career in comics. Word Balloon is sponsored by InStock Trades at InStockTrades.com. InStock Trades offers a huge selection of trade paperbacks, hardcovers, essentials, showcases, archives, absolute editions, omnibus editions, and more, all at up to 35% off with orders over $50 receiving free shipping. And don't forget to visit InStock Trades' sister site, Discount Comic Book Service, at dcbservice.com for all your pre-order needs. Major publishers are 40% off, and monthly specials are 45 to 75% off every month. Visit InStock Trades at InStockTrades.com and Discount Comic Book Service at dcbservice.com. Thanks so much for listening. This is John Suntress. Don't forget, Word Balloon, much like Tim Bradstreet, is all over the Internet. You can find us at Newsarama.com, our iTunes space. And in fact, if you'd subscribe to the iTunes feed, you're guaranteed to get a new Word Balloon episode every time one pops up. Don't forget our MySpace page, myspace.com/wordballoon, our ComicSpace page, comicspace.com/wordballoon, and we're at all the various podcatcher sites, Podcast Alley, Odeo, Podcast Pickle, you name it, we're there. Any questions about the show, I can always be reached, john@wordballoon.com. That's my email address. Thanks so much for listening. Convention season is upon us. Lots more interviews coming up. Stick around. Word Balloon is a copyright feature of Shaky Productions. Copyright 2007. All rights reserved.